Yo, people, Anna David with After Party Pod. After Party Pod is a part of After Party Magazine, a website determined to change the face and get rid of the stigma around addiction and recovery. Now, After Party is a part of RehabReviews.com, the world's largest resource for treatment centers across the globe. You can go there to see if your rehab stay could be free. Go to RehabReviews.com/benefits-check. What else can you do there, you may ask? You can get a Recover Girl t-shirt. Just go to rehabreviews.com/after-party/shop. Anyway, you'd know all of this if you were signed up for our newsletter. What are you doing? Go sign up, rehabreviews.com/newsletter-sign-up. Now here's the show.
Welcome to the After Party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturdays.
Hey, it's Anna David. After Party Pod podcast about addiction, recovery, stuff. It's a great intro so far. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. If you're not new, this is a great episode. I might say it even if it wasn't, but it happens to be true. We'll get into that in a second. I have no new emails to talk about, which is to say, where are they? I don't know. It's fine. You don't need to email me. It is nice. You know what? I don't think I ever say how you can email me. So, which means that anyone who has done some research. So why don't I make this easier? You can just email me at Anna@theafterpartygroup. Also Anna@annadavid.com, obviously. And yeah, requests for the show. Oh, I did get a suggestion for a guest. Thank you to the person who suggested that. It is a guest who's in Canada, so I don't know that it's going to happen, but God, I'm looking for the... Oh, yeah, here's the email. A guy named Joe C., who's written a meditation book called Agnostics, Atheists, Free Thinkers. It's called Beyond Belief. It sounds great. What this person suggested is that I do it over Skype, and I just have this thing, and I don't want to do it over Skype. I really, really want to do these in person. Did I tell you I'm going to New York? And did I secure some good guests? Two people that I've long wanted on the podcast that I thought would never say yes, and they both wrote right back saying yes. So I don't want to say who it is, because what if they bail? What if that yes was just, sure, she'll never email me again? But we'll see. It was terribly exciting. So that's going to happen soon. I'm actually going on a bunch of trips. Have been having LA cabin fever. I feel like I've barely left. I did go last week to like Arrowhead with Tracy Chabala, After Party magazine regular contributor Tracy Chabala. God, that was nice. I had not swam in a lake since camp, and God, that feels good. I have nothing else to say about that except that it was fantastic, and I got an amazing foot massage there. It's sort of this hippie town that's awesome and beautiful. So, and I'm going to Joshua Tree this weekend. So we'll see. Maybe I'll talk about what happens there. Maybe I won't. And then I'm going to New York and DC. And then, whatever. And then I'm going to Esalen with my mother, which for her birthday, which is really exciting. God, this sounds really obnoxious, but it's also because I have been trapped in an office working for so long. So things are very good. I hope everything is great with you guys. Let's talk about today's guest. A guy I have long wanted on this, and for some reason I know him, and for some reason I thought he would say no, and then I ran into him at a barbecue and he said yes. And he is such a fantastic writer. John Albert is his name, and he, sorry about the texting coming in. I met him because he wrote an essay for a book that I put together about 5 years ago. and it was about reality TV, and he wrote an essay on Sober House that is absolutely hilarious. And I don't tend to reread anything that involves me, but yesterday before he came in, I reread that essay, and it is laugh out loud hysterical, which is not easy when you're talking about addiction and recovery, as my writers can attest. But it's fantastic. He's sober 30 years. He looks 30, so that's weird. But he got sober at 21. And he wrote a book. Okay, so he was a musician guy. He's very modest about it. He played in Bad Religion. We'll get into that. I mean, you're going to hear all of this, so why tell you now? But he sort of accidentally became a writer and is incredibly talented, and wrote a book called The Wrecking Crew, which has been optioned, I think, several million times. That's an exaggeration, but it's a book about after he got sober from heroin, talking about this amateur baseball team made up of you know, sort of the seedy underbelly of Los Angeles, and fantastic guy. So that's about all I'm going to tell you. You're going to have to hear the rest for yourself, you guys. Here's John Albert.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God. I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky, because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
Thank you for coming in. Sorry about the exposure to my, you know, character defects of frustration.
Oh, no, I don't. I don't have those, but I'm accepting of them in other people.
You've heard of character defects. Mm-hmm. Well, you're sober a long time, so you have had a lot of time to work on yours, which is why they're all gone, right?
Yeah. Right. Yes. I don't know why it doesn't work that way, but it doesn't.
It doesn't. No. Wait, but how long are you sober?
Since I have to add it up, 12/14/85.
Jesus Christ. Well, I can't do math. What does that mean?
It's like almost 30 years.
That is crazy. And given the fact that you're 35.
Yes, no.
It's really amazing. Crazy.
I was a really, really bad baby.
So. Never slept.
Right. Colicky for chemical reasons. It's so bizarre when I think about it. I mean, you have to understand that, like, when I was using drugs, crack didn't even exist. I say that with a certain sadness.
Right, right. I say that about, well, I say, like, Quaaludes were gone.
Mm.
There was no, I certainly got sober before people were talking a lot about, like, OxyContin.
Right.
Nobody was talking.
So what year did you get sober?
I'm a class of 2000.
Oh, right. So yeah, Quaaludes were definitely gone. That, I feel a bit of sympathy
right.
for you on that.
Well, Quaaludes were apparently like the most amazing things ever.
You know, I mean, yeah, they definitely were. I mean, to be a teenager, like, they would come into town sometimes, and because there weren't a lot of them, but certain bands would come into town and bring Quaaludes, and
it was more
unspeakable things would happen.
Really?
Oh yeah. Like, I know people, I run into people now and I'm just like, oh, I remember that. Like,
but heroin was your thing.
Yes.
So is it just that the Quaaludes weren't as available, or did you like heroin more?
Well, I don't think anybody does Quaaludes, like, or when they existed, all the time. I did heroin, but if something else was available, or if heroin wasn't around and we were desperate, we would do whatever.
You know,
I lived in houses filled with people, and so I was a social addict.
So, yeah, I feel like you lived in those sort of like legendary drug houses around Hollywood, where it was just like debauchery. Mm. I feel like this just because I was just reading like various things about you this morning, and you know, and it was sort of like the Bad Religion thing happened because you were just like in some house.
Well, they were friends, but yeah, it's interesting. They were just friends of mine, and they needed a drummer, and I had a drum set. Like, I couldn't really play, but they were like, "Oh, we're friends." I remember they gave me their record and said, like, we're going to go play some shows in a month. And so I just played and played and played.
And but you will admit, despite your humility right now, that you got good enough to play.
I mean, I would say by the time I stopped playing drums, because I ended up having to be court committed into a rehab, I was a good drummer by then. But I learned sort of in public, which was uncomfortable, being sort of a narcissist and
wanting to be perfect.
Right. Like, I remember I played the Olympic Auditorium, and we were like, I don't know if we were the headliner or co-headliner, and it was like a couple thousand people, and we played a great show. And I remember like going backstage, and I had invited four people, and they didn't show up. And it turned out they didn't show up because they couldn't get in. And I remember going back and thinking, like, I have no friends. And I just played this whole show, and it went really well. So none of that sort of overcomes, like, your internal stuff.
Right.
But I was never, like, a serious musician. I was just a person that hung around the scene and played in some bands. Like, I never thought, oh, this is what I'm going to do with my life, you know.
But why did you have a drum set?
Well, I had a drum set because I lived in a house full of people that played guitar. And we would, like, get high and play old Stooges songs. And I figured if I played guitar, I could play a little guitar. It was not good. Then I wouldn't be a part of things. I mean, I would just be on the sideline. But nobody played drums, so I got a drum set. And I could play drums okay. So I just played drums. I mean, it was a casual drummer.
But when you got sober, did you never play again?
I didn't. I played a little bit in like one project, but not seriously. I never played seriously again. I'm not sure why. I mean, it just didn't seem like it just wasn't what I was going to do. And for a while after getting sober, didn't go back to my old life. I mean, like, everyone sort of, there's this idea, I think, that you can go to rehab for 30 days and then go back to your old life, but just not use drugs. And that wasn't my experience. I was in a recovery house for 18 months. Then I went and I lived with a bunch of middle-aged ex-convicts out in the San Gabriel Valley for another year.
As in, like, sober living?
It wasn't sober living. It was an apartment complex that sort of people from this recovery house would share apartments. So it was somewhat like sober living. And
did sober living not really exist back in your era?
I think it did, maybe.
But it was
a little
called
bit.
Like halfway housing.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't the booming business that it is now.
Yeah. Do you want to open a sober living with me? Because that's the business to be in.
Well, I have a garage if you get some army cots and like...
Seriously, I think we can charge like $5,000 a month.
It's amazing because I remember working in a rehab and there were people who had 60 days, maybe, that were opening sober livings. It was like the same thing as selling water filters or, you know, some sort of, like, you know, any kind of pyramid scheme. Or, I mean, it was just a quick money thing.
But some of them are amazing and great. It does seem like, anyone with a garage is doing that right now.
Well, I know that one of the interesting things is I worked in recovery in this sort of time when it was extremely unregulated. I don't know if it is now, but in the late 80s, sort of San Fernando Valley, you know, stars, like heavy metal people, like, you know, all that, like Motley Crue. You know, I worked at that place.
What place was it?
It was called Van Nuys Hospital at the time. It was, they had a weird name. ASAP was the company. They weren't people in recovery that started it. It was like a army psychologist or something that started this whole thing. And they would have these late night commercials that would say, like, we know how you got here. We know we can get you back. But it was just strictly for profit. And they had a contract with the NBA, and they had all the sort of hairband people in there. And
So okay, let's go back a tiny bit. I mean, are you from L.A.?
Mm-hmm. I grew up in Claremont, which is like 30 miles east of here. It's a college town. my dad was a professor, tenured professor. My mom, also a professor.
What were they professors
of? Well, my mom was a clinical social worker. She taught at USC in Loma Linda. My dad was taught at one college his whole life, and he was a research psychologist.
And do you have siblings?
I have a brother, yes.
And did you go to school where they taught?
I went to my dad's college for less than a year because mm-hmm. it was available. At the time, there was a deal where, like, I could go.
Yeah.
Which was a bad idea because I was on methadone and I was kind of a wreck. And
that doesn't go with college very well.
Well, maybe for some people it did, but it was more embarrassing because my dad taught there, so he had to be aware of the fact that I was, like, you know, in a class with my head on the desk, you know, snoring. Drilling. And yeah.
What and is there alcoholism in your family?
My mom's mom had alcoholism, died of stomach cancer, probably maybe related to it. There's definitely a lot of neuroses and weirdness, you know.
Like, I mean, mental illness?
No, I wouldn't go far as to say mental illness, but I mean, my dad had an interesting story. His mom died in childbirth. His father blamed him. His father put him in an orphanage, and he lived in an orphanage for a while. Then his dad came and got him, and they, like, moved to Hollywood, and he was a traveling sort of, I don't know what, salesman, or, you know, starting failing businesses all the time, and they just moved around, and he never really forgave my dad for something that wasn't his fault, obviously. So my dad had his own stuff. I mean, he was clinically depressed. My mom grew up with an alcoholic mother, so those things were around, but it wasn't, you know, neither my mom nor my dad or any of their siblings were alcoholics or addicts, you know. My mom, maybe. I mean, I talk to my mom all the time she likes to drink a lot of wine.
Yeah.
But she's 80 years old, so let her do it.
And it seems to have managed her life just
fine. Right. It's not like, yeah, she's not ruining her future right now by drinking wine.
Right. And you must have started pretty young for you to manage to be already on methadone by college.
Oh, yeah. I think I started using heroin the first time, somewhere around 15, you know. And it was strange because I was, you know, my friends and I wanted to be old and jaded when we were really young, which doesn't make any sense now that I'm old. I'm
but
like,
I get
what
it.
Was I doing?
I know.
So we had a band, which was this sort of death rock band, which kept going and became famous long after I was gone, called Christian Death. And my friend Roger, who had a number of names and then ended up being called Roz, and who hung himself some years ago, who was really talented and brilliant, but we just wanted to be, you know, we didn't want to be from the Southern California suburbs. We wanted to be from somewhere that sort of was rainy and where we were sort of decadent and jaded, as I said. And I don't
know. Portland, is that where you wanted to be from?
No, I think Berlin, maybe.
Okay.
Portland was not like that back then. But so we just, you know, we were listening to all that cliche music, Lou Reed, and think, you know, I mean, we were huge David Bowie fans, and especially like David Bowie when he was in Berlin. And there was a lot, you know, we were already doing drugs. I'd started smoking pot as a child and doing hallucinogens.
As a child?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, it was sort of the 70s, and there was a, you know, it was just like part of growing up was like smoking pot and skateboarding and things like that. I mean, it was just...
And your friends just had it. Like 10, 11?
Certainly by 11.
Look at 11-year-olds today. Does that freak you out?
It totally freaks me out because they're children.
They're babies.
Right. But there's a difference. Like, I don't... You know, like when I was growing up, we would just roam the streets. And it wasn't that my parents were apathetic. Like, you know, it was like, just come home for dinner.
Yeah.
And we would, like, you know, just go off with our skateboards and smoke weed and skate and listen to, like, music, you know.
Have you seen Diary of an American Teenager?
Mm-mm.
It's a great movie, out now. Shout out to that movie. But it's a 1976 girl growing up in the hate.
Oh, right, right.
And yeah, I mean, and it made me realize, because she was actually older than I was at that, which is super fun to say because I never get to say that. And it made me realize, like, I'm really glad, because I was actually lived in the hate my first 2 years of life.
Yeah.
I was really glad my parents were as uncool as they are, yeah. and that it wasn't, you know, 10 years, 5 years earlier, because it was crazy.
But, it's interesting, because I know a lot of kids that grew up in that, from who were the sort of children of the hippies.
Yeah.
And my parents were not that. My dad was a professor of the hippies, I guess.
Right.
But those kids are, there's some severe damage. Like, you know, kids, I mean, some of them are really right-wing. Some of them, a lot of them were drug addicts.
So damaged in that way by being right-wing.
Right.
That's worse than becoming a drug addict.
Right, worse than that. Those kids were, there was some serious neglect. I know kids that grew up in communes and all of that.
What was interesting to me about seeing that movie is that I was such an innocent at that age, and it's sort of my going down happened later.
Right.
From like 12 to 16, I was a total innocent.
Wow.
And I remember a friend telling me, I guess I was probably 13, a friend telling me she went on a camping trip and she smoked a cigarette, several cigarettes, and made out with some guy. And I remember writing a journal entry. I was so freaked out.
But see, like, I was, before even drugs, like, I was addicted to getting in trouble.
Really?
So, and this becomes really sort of like primitive, and you know, it was like shoplifting candy,
mm-hmm.
and then it was like things, and this just makes no sense, but like just acts of awful vandalism, like, you know, throwing rocks at cars and
that's so frightening,
you know, things like that, because the adrenaline rush, like when the car would stop, and like, and I wasn't alone, so I, you know, I mean, it wasn't like I had this like mental illness that I suffered in isolation. Like, all my friends were doing the same thing.
I just read this book about psychopaths called The Psychopath.
Yeah, I've read it.
Oh, God, he's so funny.
Right. I'm not a psychopath.
But he does talk about how as a kid you did, well, it was mostly like torturing animals.
Yeah, I never tortured animals, and I never even came close. I mean, I love animals, but torturing adults.
Right.
You know, and
that's not on the list.
Yeah.
Psychopathic tendencies.
I got pulled out of elementary school by the police twice, you know.
For stuff like throwing rocks.
Well, one was, we had a friend of ours went to Mexico, and we had him bring back fireworks, but like M80s and M200s and switchblades and things like that.
Jesus.
And the other, this is great. So the kindergartners out of my elementary school had a vegetable garden, and so we planted pot plants in, like, within their vegetable garden.
Oh, my God.
So that they would nurture our plants, and we got somebody told on us for that.
That's an amazing idea, though.
Yeah, it was good. They were
nice. Did you ever get the pot, or you got in trouble before?
No, both times they got the pot, or somebody got the pot, and then the police came and used all our firecrackers in a anti-firecrackers demonstration for the school. So we got to watch them explode, but it was
not the way you'd intended.
No. But the thing was, like, we were just into getting into trouble, and I don't know what that was, mm-hmm. you know. And so drugs, it wasn't like, you know, somebody said, like, do you want to smoke pot? And I thought, no, I shouldn't do that. It was
right.
Like, this is, there was an excitement about it, you know.
I know very few people who thought, no, I shouldn't do that. I mean, I know I just was saying I was so freaked out by my friend, but by the time it came along and was offered to me anything, I never thought
right.
I shouldn't do that.
Right.
I just thought that those warnings don't apply to me.
Right.
Or I never thought of the warnings.
Yeah, I mean, and with heroin, it's a, you know, you've heard your whole life that this is like a bad thing, but then people that you really respect are doing it, both, you know, musicians and artists and writers, and then older people I knew were doing it as well. Like, even in the neighborhood I grew up with, which was just a college town, there were older kids doing it, and I knew them. And And then when I did it, it just fixed me like nothing else.
How?
You know, it's what is it like? It's like you know that cliche Tom Cruise "You Complete Me" thing. It was like it just fixed me in a way that like I felt like a normal person. It made me okay wherever I was. You know, I remember just doing it and thinking, "This is it." Like there was something there, you know. And right away, I just wanted more.
Had you been conscious up until that point of being uncomfortable, or until you felt that you didn't realize?
Well, I was starting, that was like sort of early teen years. I was not a happy teenager. Mm-hmm. You know, I was at war with my family. I was at war with my school. I got thrown out of school for truancy, mm-hmm. So I didn't, I wasn't sort of fitting in the world, and I didn't have an idea of where I was going, and there was a lot of emotional turbulence happening. Mm-hmm. A lot of it came out as anger and defiance, but I knew I wasn't happy. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't look back on my teen years and think, God, those were such great years.
But who does?
Well, some people do.
I look back on my college years and think that all the time.
Right.
Which is weird.
Well, but that's cool because that's more something you do. Like, that's your life.
Yeah.
When you're a teenager, you're sort of like still half child.
It was awful.
Yeah.
Well, and so did you, the first time you did heroin, you shot it. You didn't like...
No, I shot it. Well, I remember the first time... The first time I shot heroin, I think, was someone who was around still, who's a fairly renowned performance artist, Ron Athey, mm-hmm. Who got in trouble with Jesse Helms and all those people. He was there, and he was living with my friend Roz in this sort of building in South Pomona, which is a ghetto. And I was down there, and they were just doing it, and I remember just literally sticking my arm out, and they shot me up, and I think I threw up, and then I was like, this is really good. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I ever snorted heroin in my life, you know, because I like the fix. I like the immediacy of shooting drugs, which, you know, then led to all sorts of other stuff, you know. Shooting drugs has its own baggage for sure.
Well, understatement of the podcast with many understatements. What and how many years were you an active heroin addict?
Well, if I did it at 15, by 16 I was probably doing it regularly. And then by 21 was done.
Yeah.
But done because of legalities, not, you know.
Well, so as I told you, I reread. So you wrote a story called The After Party, which we already clarified before we started recording. I did not plagiarize your title with the name of the site. And the reason it was my title is that when I wrote Party Girl, my first book, my agent said, oh, we can't sell it under this title because there's another book called Party Girl. And her then boyfriend, now husband, who I just want to name drop because I'd like to do that. Andrew Ross Sorkin, who like became he's like the main financial reporter for the Times, and he wrote Too Big to Fail, and this is like, so he said, why don't they call it why doesn't she call it After Party? Which makes sense. And we did when we sold it, and then it didn't matter until we changed it back to Party Girl. And so when you wrote your story, I had that title in my head.
It works also for that. Works for that story because it's sort of like what happens after the party.
Right. Well, exactly.
But it's a great time.
Okay. And so you wrote, and I was thinking about this. I was reminiscing about our relationship this morning when, so Mark Ebner, previous podcast guest, Mark Ebner, and he talked about this when he was on the podcast, so it's totally fine. He was going to write a story about, I think, about Sober House.
Right.
And he started to get really flaky and weird. And now he told me it was because he had started smoking pot then. And so he didn't feel that he was an appropriate person to write that essay. And he recommended you. And I'm not just blowing smoke, but it is truly one of my favorite essays from the book. And I was just telling you, there's a girl who constantly tells me it was her favorite. And it's so funny. And let's talk about that story. So are you still a reality TV addict?
No, I don't watch any reality TV anymore because it just, like, I could literally feel my brain sort of being destroyed as I watched it. And, you know, I mean, I will say I get addicted to a lot of things. Food, like different foods. Like if I eat a food and I have a good experience, like if I'm eating, you know, a corn dog and watching the Dodgers play and they win and I have a great evening, I will then eat corn dogs and watch the Dodgers, you know, even if they go on a losing streak and I get like really bad, like acid reflux, I'll watch it. I'll do the same thing until it's just intolerable.
Does the food always have to connect to an experience?
Well, I'm just saying, like, whatever the experience that brings me pleasure, I will follow it. So reality TV was, like, I think most people, I watched it for some weird reasons, but it stopped working.
Right.
And I just felt too bad. And reality TV is sort of went from being voyeuristic and entertaining and kind of creepy to like really awful. I mean,
It did. I had the same experience. By the way, I should clarify that so it was for a book called Reality Matters, which anyone listening should obviously go buy immediately.
For sure, yes.
And it was a book about reality TV, where I got far better known writers than me to write essays about reality TV.
Yeah.
And the reason I did that is I too was obsessed with reality TV. Yeah. And the interesting thing about that is that I got sober. I remember the night I bottomed out, which was watching The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills and waking up the next morning and feeling soul sick. And I haven't had TV in so long. And what's so weird is this is so embarrassing. Last night, people were like tweeting about the VH1 awards. And today I called and got cable.
Oh, no.
So I might be going, this could be the beginning of a relapse.
Oh, boy.
But yeah, So Sober House, you watch. We've had a couple Sober House people on this podcast, Jennifer Jimenez, and I'm sure some others, Mackenzie Phillips, I can't remember if she was on it, but Amber Smith, who you reference it anyway. So you wrote this story about Sober House, and in it, you went and confronted, I don't know how well you remember this, I don't remember what I wrote yesterday, but but you reached out to David Weintraub.
Yeah, I was watching the show, and what the really strange part was, they were still filming the show.
Right.
So, and I somehow reached out to him and ended up having lunch and this really bizarre discussion with them while the show was unresolved.
Right.
And I thought he was, I don't know what he's doing now, but
I know, it made me want to look him up rereading that essay.
But they were there. I mean, they were very strange. And he was the villain of that season.
Right. And so he was, for anyone who doesn't remember or didn't watch, so they would have, you know, it was Seth Binzer and Mary Carey, the porn star.
Yeah.
And Andy Dick and other people. And it was after Celebrity Rehab. They would go to Sober Living. And David managed all of those people.
Yes, yes. Well, it got weird because he sort of filled me in on the behind the scenes part, which was that he was negotiating contracts for all of them. And sometimes they were prolonging their drug use so that they would go into rehab at the opportune time to film the show.
That is madness.
But it was known, like, you know, without incriminating all the people involved, but let's do that.
Well, I also would like to say, look at the source. I mean, David seemed to be not the most honest person.
No, but I will say this. I have talked to other people in that world who are around that particular scene, and they have confirmed that. Okay. So it maybe it didn't happen with everybody, but it definitely happened with some people. And
I sort of have people who sort of criticize that at that show. I don't know. It seems unlikely to me, but I don't know.
It could be, and I'm not. I don't know.
You know, because I wrote Tom Sizemore's book, and so I heard a lot about. I mean, he was out of. They had to like crawl into some drug den to get him on the show.
Right.
And throw pizza over a fence. I mean, it was like crazy craziness. But they certainly weren't encouraging him to use.
I don't think that. I don't think they were encouraging people to use. I don't know that it was that direct. I think that. Maybe their when they got sober was a secondary factor and they just needed people for the show. I have no idea. I mean, you're right. He's not a credible source. But I think that I think the priorities of the people involved might have been...
Gotten confused, gotten possibly.
I would say confusion is a euphemism for... I mean, I know there's a lot of... Listen, I know a lot of people who are... working who are on those shows that are great people and are not mercenary and care about people and like in a profound way, so I'm not saying that everyone is tainted with that, but listen, the intersection between commerce and recovery is a really, really precarious place. I know people that have opened rehabs and their lives have gone completely haywire and they've been seduced by the money and made just obviously questionable decisions and have some have been in the press and some haven't. And I'm not saying that that wouldn't happen to any of us. I mean, who knows? But it's a dangerous place.
I know. I mean, and I have some exposure to that doing this.
Right.
And some initial conflict about, oh, this is something around recovery and you're not supposed to take any money for it. And then it's like, well, no, this is a business and it's not. And let's be totally clear. I'm not making enough money that there's any seduction to go to the dark side.
But you're not saying that this is a way of
treatment.
Saving people.
Yeah.
This is... sort of an adjacent entertainment thought thing, it's different. But like, going back to our joking about sober living houses, and people opening those up to make money, there's, as long as I can remember, rehabs have been in trouble for a lot of questionable decisions.
I thought that was something new since I started paying attention to it.
No.
So it's always, even in the 80s.
Well, when I worked at the, Van Nuys Hospital, there were two deaths on the facility that they covered up. And there was abuse by a well-known interventionist who's now dead that was covered up. And this was sort of the premier star recovery place at the time.
Were his initials BT?
They were.
Yeah, okay, I've heard about that.
Yeah. And I was privy to that because I was working there at the time. And there was no question about what had happened.
Right.
So that's always been happening,
Yeah, it's interesting. I just had no idea. I went through treatment and I had absolutely no idea. And I was one of these people who had just like a really great experience with it.
I think there's great treatment out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I was someone who was just completely closed off to the idea of 12-step and then sort of felt like I got tricked into it there because group was a lot like 12-step.
Oh, yeah.
And I like liked group. And then I got in a druggy buggy and went to, 12-step. And I was like, oh, this is like group. Okay. I love this.
Yeah.
So how many treatment centers did you go through?
I don't know, probably like five maybe, but those were sort of, of those five, some of them were like 2 weeks, like just detox and sit around and eat yogurt and watch Miami Vice, you know.
Right.
That, so that's not really treatment. I went, you know, the first one I went to as a teenager because I got, you know, I was starting to really get in trouble and I had drained my parents' bank account. And then, there, you know, it was every time I would
really... Stealing, or they were paying for you.
No, I had stolen from them.
Yeah.
I stole. And I was stealing a lot. To,
right.
You know, as a teenage, you know, heroin addict, that was...
Like probably, cars?
No, but just stealing from people.
Breaking into houses or no?
Doing a lot of serious shoplifting, stealing mail, stealing checks. I mean, I don't want to get into it too much, but I got caught for a lot of it.
You got caught, and yeah. They would send you to treatment. Did you ever go to jail?
Yeah. I mean, what happened was before the internet, and this really dates me, but so there wasn't the internet, so that different counties weren't connected. So you would get arrested in one county, and then that would be like a case, and then you'd get arrested in another county, and that would be a case, and they wouldn't just connect them all. But then eventually they would.
Right.
So then it was like, oh, you're in real trouble and you're going to prison. And I'm like, I had friends that were already in prison by then. And
right.
I didn't want to go to prison. So I went to a recovery house and to fight my court cases.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I would, they would take me to court, they would just say, well, come back in another few months.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I stayed initially. Because I'd stayed, and then by the time my court cases were resolved, I was like, it had worked.
Yeah, in your Sober House essay, you talk about how you basically like did drugs in like I think 4 treatment centers and jumped out a window of one to escape.
And I also crossed over into the psych ward for romance twice.
You mean hooking up in rehab?
Yeah, but not in the rehab. In 2 different ones, there were neighboring psych wards, which were just like straight up, you know, mental illness. Like,
mm-hmm.
And so when I was looking for a date, that's where I went. I think I hooked up in almost everyone at the time and got high in everyone. The last time I jumped out a window, and then they drilled the window shut, and then I went. So I fled down the elevator and through the ER, but I was only wearing a hospital gown, and it wasn't really secure, so I was sort of streaking.
How long did you escape before they found you?
Well, that was the last night. Then what happened was I went off. I convinced a friend to pick me up, reluctantly, because not a lot of people wanted me around. We didn't get high. I got high. I did his drugs and my drugs just like in an impulsive. I just grabbed them all and did them. And he was pissed off. And I was, so he just dumped me off at the hospital and pushed me out of the car.
Mm-hmm.
They put me back in my room. And the next day, some convict with a mustache picked me up and took me to Impact House.
Okay. And that's where you stayed.
That's where I stayed. And then I did not leave there and stayed there for 18 months.
And were you surprised? I mean, what happened? When did you decide, you know what, actually I could do this?
Well, I stayed there for a while because of the court cases. But also, it was, you know, there's a sort of self-indulgent thing that happens in like real detoxes where that you sort of like, there's all this sort of talk about the intellectual aspects of addiction. And here we're going to have a seminar on this and a seminar on that. We're going to discuss this. And that didn't do anything for me because I came from a really intellectual household.
Right.
So what Impact did was you're going to wake up, you're going to make your fucking bed, you're going to wash dishes, you're going to be accountable for every single action. If you do anything wrong, there's consequences. And it gave me that sort of classic rite of passage to being an adult,
right.
Which I needed. That's
yeah.
what I needed. So that model worked for me.
Yeah.
Way more, you know, I could be the best patient at any rehab because I knew, listen, my dad was a research psychologist. My mom was a clinical social worker. I could talk in group and seem great.
Right.
And then crawl out a window and have sex with, you know, I'm borderline schizophrenic. But what I needed was that sort of Marine boot camp 12-step mix.
And did you have a moment where you decided, I want to be sober? Or did it just, was it such
Well, it wasn't that. It was, it wasn't ever like, oh, I don't enjoy the feeling of drugs. It was, I always had this idea when I was in my darkest times that I will get a chance for this to be over. And I realized that this was that time. Mm-hmm. And I probably wouldn't get another chance. What I didn't, like, I like the feeling of the drugs, but it made everything eventually worse. Every bit of depression and loneliness and confusion in my life got worse and worse. And, you know, there was that time where, I could do so many drugs in one sitting and it wouldn't get rid of those feelings. I mean, that actually happened. And I wanted to not feel that way anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it couldn't get rid of the loneliness. It couldn't get rid of the fact that I just felt like my life was over, you know, and at that age. And so I just felt like I had been saved in a mm-hmm. way. And I was so profoundly grateful not to feel those feelings that I was willing to do anything to keep going in that direction. And so I just did whatever they said, whatever they said.
Do you miss doing drugs?
Not really. I mean, I've had surgeries and I've had painkillers because I've had surgeries before, and it's mildly pleasant, but it's also irritating. Mm-hmm. The reasons that I did drugs don't exist that much anymore. You know, I feel more connected to the world. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not somebody that believes that like alcoholism is one thing and addiction is one thing and that we all feel the same way. Mm-hmm. I kind of reject that. I mean, I know that there's a lot of controversy about that. But the reasons drugs like heroin and alcohol and all those drugs made sense, regardless of cost, is because of the way I felt. And I just don't feel that way anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a lot. That's a number of things. That's growing up, one. That's being in recovery and constantly sort of facing life and learning how to face life in a different way. Mm-hmm. And having friends, you know, having a life, being connected to the world.
In terms of thinking, like I think about what you said about how you did this big show and then your friends didn't show up and you thought, well, I have no friends. Mm. And that I sort of thought, oh, that's alcoholic thinking. You know, that's sort of where the mind... My mind will naturally go. Oh, yeah. It will look for evidence of something that is not true, but it's sort of some intrinsic belief yeah. that I'm trying to validate. Do you believe that that was part of the isolation and that's what you have been able to conquer?
Well, I don't think that I was had Asperger's or anything like that, but maybe elements of that because mm-hmm. I don't know, it's hard because I was extremely social mm-hmm. and had lots of friends and really cool friends, but I had an incredible discomfort being around people and a hard time dealing with life. And so I thought that I was destined to be alone a lot of the time, and a drug like heroin makes being alone fine.
Yeah.
You know, like I always say, like if I had, you know, my dream back then was TV set, some heroin, maybe some alcohol, and something to eat, you know? Mm-hmm. And it didn't involve people at all.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't feel that's my destiny now to be alone, you know?
Well, but interesting when you came in this office and you said, now, okay, it's all these people working together. Now, how do you not just sit and not talk to them?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but these are skills that I've just now developed. Like the idea that, like I walk around my neighborhood and I know a lot of people and I talk to them. And then sometimes I think like, what happened to me? Like,
right.
Like I sit in the coffee shop down the street sometimes and work and I get irritated because people I know walk in and start conversations. And that is a, just a profound change.
Right.
You know, even I've had like periods of incredible isolation in recovery.
Right.
You know, sort of self-imposed exiles into my own world. But it's just a lot different. And those are things like that is recovery to me. Like being okay, like I can go to a party now and just chit chat and or not and be fine. That's, you know, maybe that's just time, but it's also, those are skills that I think you learn in recovery, or I learned in recovery.
Yeah. Yeah. Mine was sort of similar. I just, you know, I've always kind of needed people around. I mean, except those years I was doing coke alone. Like it could, you know, cocaine, it doesn't make you okay being alone, but it makes you not want anyone around, which is why it was sort of awful. Like the drugs don't work in the end for me. Yeah. But I think that I used to be so intolerant of people that them like it'll trip me out here in this office that I'm like go have all these friends here.
Yeah.
Because I used to sort of be like, I'll be friends with one or two people that I deem okay, cool enough. And that's really changed in recovery.
Well, I mean, there was an article that came out recently and they were talking about the idea and I think it was mainly in Europe, which is that like the way they're dealing with drug addiction is reconnecting people into society in a like a real sort of profound way. Like, and I think that works. Like I really do. I mean, I think like listen, there's a lot of self-discovery and self-healing that happens in recovery, but there's also this idea that you become part of this community.
Yeah.
And I think that is incredibly helpful.
Yes.
And you know, and there's a reason that people that are in, you know, poverty do drugs a lot more, you know, people that don't have a stake in the world and are sort of disconnected. And you know, and it's sort of like the catch-22 of like the more drugs you do, the more disconnected you become.
Right.
So it's this road sort of out of the world. But I think when you put people back in the world and connect them, they're less likely to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. There was this Jonah Hari, this guy who he did a TED Talk and he wrote a book and it's all about that. But it's interesting because all the criticism of 12-step right now, that's sort of, you know, people get so hung up on the spiritual aspect, which they consider to be the religious aspect, that they overlook that this community is kind of what can make all the difference.
Yeah, and that's sort of like, listen, I had a neighbor that was an ex-cult member and who drank himself to death. Like, he wasn't just a neighbor. We, like, shared a wall. And I watched him drink himself to death, and he would not go to AA because of the spiritual aspect.
Right.
Which, because he had been in a cult and he was damaged by that and he was so scared of that. But listen, I mean, I'm an atheist. I'm a total, like, you know, I adhere to science. I don't believe in much spiritualism. I don't believe in astrology. I don't believe in any of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I have a whole bunch of friends that are the same way. Mm-hmm. And we are productive members of,
right,
you know, of the 12-step programs. And so nobody has ever come to me and said, you can't be here, that what you're thinking is wrong. I think that there's a lot more people than sort of it's talked about that don't believe in all of that. And it works fine.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you, and so you don't, so what do you credit with the shift? What you said, which is basically you felt so much better that,
well,
anything was worth it.
You know, it's like the result is the same. It's just what you're attributing,
yeah,
the change to. Like, I don't believe in a, you know, a God that cares whether like I get a job or have a good relationship, a bad relationship, or any of that. I don't believe that. I believe the universe is incredibly complex and doesn't, you know, I'm just a teeny part of it, but that doesn't mean that doing the right thing doesn't feel good and feel right, better, and that being a good person is without value. You know, I mean, I talk about this with a lot of people. I have a friend, I was just had a phone conversation with my friend Greg Graffin, who's the singer for Bad Religion, who's also an evolutionary biologist and teaches at Cornell. And, you know, he's an incredibly moral person, as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. It's not like having no spiritualism means nihilism, you know?
Right.
I think there's a ton of people, and I only say, listen, I'm not critical of anybody's beliefs. I'm sort of public about that because I think there is that sort of mischaracterization that this is a program that's based, you know, maybe at one time it was based on, you know, sort of Christian values or Catholicism, mm-hmm. but you don't need to believe those things to get recovery.
No. I did want to talk about how you, it almost sounds like randomly became a writer. I mean, that's sort of how it's built.
Well, no, that's what happened. I went back to school. I went to film school. And I wrote some stuff in film school, but those were sort of scripts. And then I did what totally made sense, was I got out of this prestigious film school and I went to work for a surfboard company and didn't do anything but surf, mm-hmm. and which is sort of self-destructive. And then I just had this story about, like, I was playing baseball with these guys and I thought, oh, this is such a weird story. And so I submitted it to the LA Weekly under their Best of LA, under some weird, you know.
So best of, like, meaning the best team?
Well, no, but it's, you know, that's sort of like best donuts, best.
Right, right.
Know. So this was going to be, I don't know, it didn't really fit, but somebody suggested it. So I sent in like two paragraphs and I thought, like, maybe this is like your best junky cross-dressing amateur baseball team. And they basically came back and said, well, this doesn't really fit into the best of. Would you want to write this as a story? I'd written one short piece for a surf magazine, which was sort of an interview profile for a friend's magazine. And I lied and said that I'd written all sorts of more stuff. And so that was my first piece. And it ended up being a cover story. And it won a national sports writing award. And so then I had another career.
Well, and it's like the most option story in Hollywood.
It is, which is sort of like a blessing and a curse. It's been optioned so many times and come close to being made so many times. It's optioned right now. I don't know why it hasn't sort of moved to the next level. I mean, there's been scripts written. People have been paid close to $1 million to write scripts.
Jesus.
The last option before this was Philip Seymour Hoffman, and that didn't work out for obvious reasons. And now it's optioned again. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I wrote, because what happened was, the article came out, and then I got this career as a journalist, and then I was literally given a book deal, which probably makes people sick, but I was like, you know, and I said, I don't think there's a book here. And they said, just take the money and write the book.
It actually makes me more sick that you got in the LA Weekly, because they were like kept rejecting me. So sorry, personal side. Go on.
But I wrote the book thinking it was a movie. You know, I mean, I wrote it like a movie, but it's been hard, I think, to translate tonally into, because people write scripts and I read them and I think, this is okay.
Did you ever write one of the scripts?
No. I've never done that. The reason being is that at least previously I wanted the option money and I wanted and the next step was packaging money. And so if you get the studio together with a writer, then you get more money. And I just didn't want to, I needed the money.
Yeah.
I tell people, like, the book and it's continually being optioned is like having a teeny little oil well in your backyard.
Right.
That you just get a little check every once in a while. And I never sort of had the time and patience to, like, do that. And I don't know that I could, you know, I don't know that I would be better than, you know, Rick Cleveland, who wrote for Six Feet Under, who,
right.
you know, and he wrote it, you know, he's a great writer, and, you know, and I don't think that his version got the tone. And he said, I don't know how to do this. I wish you had written your book before, because he wrote it off the piece.
Oh, interesting.
But since the book's been written, there's been versions right. done, and I don't know. It's difficult.
Yeah, I had, with my first one, offers came in, and I was like, I went with the highest paying one. I didn't care if it sounded like the highest yeah. quality one. I just was like, I want money.
I get it.
And I knew the chances of it getting made were minuscule.
Right.
And what's strange about my situation is a script was a script by, at that point, my dream writer. It was the woman who wrote Reality Bites, which was right. the seminal movie of the 20s. And then, as will happen, just I never heard from the producers again. They said, we're hiring her. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe it. I never heard from those people again. I emailed them, never heard back.
Wow.
And then, you know, the agent contacted me maybe a year later and said, oh, by the way, you the option reverted back to you. Randomly, I wrote something about this, and the writer, the screenwriter, got in touch with me and said, you never saw the script, and she sent it to me. So, so you know, I guess 6 years after I wrote a book based on my life, I read a screenwriter's version of my book based on my right. life from 10 years earlier. It was so strange.
And how was the script?
It was interesting. I can't reread anything I write, yeah. so I barely remembered the book. It was, you know, it was interesting. I, at one point, somebody who wanted to, Melanie Griffith wanted to option. She was one of the people who wanted to option right. the book. And she said, I want you to write the script. And I tried, and it was God awful.
It's hard.
I wish that I knew how to do that extremely lucrative form of writing, and I don't.
It's really difficult. And especially, I think, when you care so much, it's really difficult.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole other thing. If, you know, now once somebody has spent money on a property, then anybody involved in that can't ever be involved in it again, or you have to recoup all that money.
Oh God.
So there's like this like increasing like
group of people that you can't.
Right. So, you know, like it's interesting.
Because you're going to run out of people in Hollywood at some
point. Well, two people have died. So, you know, there was another person that optioned that died. So, wow. I don't know. Maybe we'll see what happens. I mean, I don't think about it as much as I did originally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, initially I wrote a book or wrote a story, and then it was a studio thing, and it was in the LA Times and all that. And I thought, oh, my life is going to change.
Yeah.
This is going to be great. And then it didn't happen. And now that's happened so many times, I just don't believe it. Even if people like tell me, oh, there's this great news, this has happened, I'm like, yeah, whatever. You know, I'm pretty jaded now.
Question. And this, we do have to wrap up. And yeah. so this is just such a brilliant way to end.
Yeah.
Have you at this point in your recovery kind of gotten to the point where you realize that nothing is going to change overnight? In that, like, let's say you walk out of here and there was a call and it was like, we're actually going into production right now.
Yeah.
And this belief that we all buy into, that this is going to be the thing that will bring me everlasting happiness.
Well, that was the thing. See, like, I even in recovery, I lived for years with this idea that there was some event that was going to happen that was going to change my life and
right.
make everything okay. And I lived in sort of a nervous anticipation of that happening. And then I realized that life is just happening in between all those moments.
Yeah.
And I've had enough friends that have had those moments happen too, and their lives don't change.
Right.
I have friends that have made tons of money, been incredibly successful, lost it all, gained it all back. And none of those things have been the really valuable parts of their lives.
Right.
And I've seen people make a lot of money and be miserable. I've seen people not make money and be happy. So it doesn't matter that much. That said, I would be really happy if that call happened.
Right.
You know, because it would just take off the table whatever anxiety I have about money.
But would it? I mean, yes and no.
Well, great. You're absolutely right. Like, so I have a friend that just made a bunch of money in music and bought a big house and has this great life and is scared to death because how does he sustain it now?
Yeah.
Now he has all these new responsibilities.
Yeah.
You know, you move out of your apartment, you get a better car, you get this you know, it's just a big change. And
more money, more problems.
Right. So, you know, I work sometimes, I work at a record company, like, consistently. And, you know, one of the things my friend Brett tells artists, he owns the record company, is that take your money, but don't change your life, because the trajectory is so fast in both directions. And nobody ever believes him.
Right.
They don't ever believe him. They think that whatever increase in income they had this year, it will just keep going that way.
Right.
And I've talked to so many of those people on the way down, and they're, you know, they're humble and they laugh about it, but it's inevitable.
Right.
I mean, so...
Yeah, I do think when it's not that dramatic thing, but when people are slowly working their way up, that it's not really that. But I suddenly was like, oh my God, my income next year is going to be on, because I'm a narcissist, and any story that has to do with someone else, I immediately am like, stop listening and think about what it has to do with me. But yeah, I think it's more true when it's like the MC Hammer story.
For sure. And I think you become more responsible after a while. And like, you know, if you make money, you think, like now I don't think, oh, if I made money, I'd buy like, you know, a great flashy car or anything. I think, I'd invest it in like real estate or something.
Right.
You know? And some people do that, but you know, like youth is wasted on the young. A lot of times fast money is wasted on the young. You know?
Right.
So.
Right.
I don't have to worry about that anymore. Like, you
know. Well, I hope if you get it to circle back, you'll just open a sober living.
Yeah. Maybe. Maybe that's the way to make fast money.
It is. It is today. Well, this is fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming in. So that was After Party Pod with John Albert, writer, drummer, ex-drummer, former heroin addict, now sober 3 decades. I hope you loved the episode. I hope you will listen to next week's episode. And review us. Why not? Okay, bye.